From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 247, recorded live Thursday, January 30th, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with John Wilger about going from Agile consultant to Agile team member.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today, we have a studio guest. And by studio guest, I mean my spare bedroom now has a person in it, which is great. So we're doing a local show here, and I'm sitting with my friend John Wilger, who has been so kind as to join me on his vacation. How's it going?
Pretty good.
Thanks for coming by, and you may hear the ambient noises of two small children upstairs beating their heads into the ground. So, put up with that.
Which was quieter than my four kids at home. So
it was a good choice that we came here. So you were a consultant for a long time, and then came to work at the company that you're at right now, which is a change from what you were doing before. Talk to me about that.
Right. So the company I work for now is Renewable Funding, and was originally just Project DX here in Portland. And I started consulting with them in 2008 and came on for a couple of reasons, basically to do some agile coaching for a small team and also to help lead some of the technology because they were starting to implement the site in Rails. Really enjoyed the team that I was working with there. They really kind of got agile development really well. And they made me an offer to come on as a full-time employee, probably about 6 months in, and decided to take it because I really wanted to see where that team was going to go. I wanted to stick around with it. And not too long after that, the company actually ended up getting bought by Renewable Funding, who's based out of California. And the guy that was running our team at the time, decided that he wanted to move on to something else at that point. And I was given the opportunity to actually manage the team. So that's a big change for me because it was the first time for me managing a software development team from kind of the human resources perspective.
So you were an agile coach, which a lot of people kind of apply that label. I want to understand like what an agile coach does and which is a kind of management. And then you made this transition into a more kind of a formal management role.
Right. I think as far as agile coaching, the way I looked at it was, you know, you have to have a group of people that are interested in doing agile correctly. And then the job of the coach is kind of to make sure, kind of guide them along the way of making good decisions. It took me a while to actually get good at doing that. In fact, when I first moved to Portland, the first job that I had here, I was brought in specifically to help transition a team to an agile development process. Had been practicing agile for several years at that point, but had never really transitioned a team to it. And made the mistake in that team of kind of coming in and just saying, okay, I've, you know, read the books, been doing this for a while, and here's how we're going to do it, and let's go ahead and change everything. And of course, there was some resistance on the team. You know, there were a couple developers that wanted to do it, but there were a couple that weren't so sold on doing things that way. And I think, you know, I wasn't there long enough to have a lot of trust with the team at that point. So I changed things, say, okay, we're going to do everything this way. And they didn't work, right? Yeah. I mean, just people resist. There were a couple of places where it fell down. And that company, you know, that's probably one of the biggest mistakes in my career, really, of doing it that way, because I think I've forever ruined Agile at that company with that move, because they kind of looked at it like, oh, okay, yeah, this Agile development stuff isn't really going to work. Let's just kind of go back to doing what we were doing before. What I took from that is that it's more important to kind of come into a position, and instead of trying to change everything right away, you got to kind of work with the people on the ground and know what problems they're facing and just sit alongside them, develop, do some pair programming if you can, things like that. And once you understand the problems that they're having, you can kind of understand, okay, let's make a little tweak here, you know, change this here, and start to move things towards an agile process, which is a little bit different than I think a lot of agile consultants want to do when they come into a place. There are a lot of people that say, oh, we need to do full immersion, and that can work. I'm not saying that it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But in my experience, I found that I was a lot more effective coming in and just kind of making small changes to kind of get people to be more effective and be able to have a more agile delivery process. Mm-hmm.
One of my friends at Microsoft named Brad Wilson, who is in the, used to be actually in a group called the Patterns and Practices teams, and now he works on the ASP.NET web team, always used this term Scrummerfall, where he would find a group that's doing waterfall, they're doing kind of classic big design up front type development, and then they would start to introduce Agile, and they would do it such a piecemeal way, they would end up in this halfway place between Scrum and waterfall, and they'd live in Scrummerfall, and they'd think that they were Agile. But it was all just a big lie, and they were just doing iterations within a larger waterfall. And when you said thinking about, you can come in and you can say, all right, everybody, stop what you're doing, full immersion, here's what we're going to do. It's all Agile all the time. Or you can start tweaking and make tiny things. And then hopefully they wake up one moment and they go, oh, wait a second, we've been doing Agile and we didn't even realize it.
Right. I think it certainly depends on the team that you're working with too. Now the teams that I've done, you know, my kind of second approach to it with have been smaller teams that I think were more on board with at least wanting to move towards an agile process, and kind of buying the philosophy.
Meaning you didn't have to sneak it up on them.
Right. I definitely didn't have to do that. In fact, I wrote on my weblog recently an article, you know, what is agile really? And it's, I think, you know, agile with a big A is different than agile with a little A. And I tend to be more of a proponent of the little A agile. And I said that there are basically two questions that you can ask to see if a team is agile. One of those is, can you react immediately and without panic if external constraints on your project change? And the second question being, do you review your process frequently and regularly to make sure that the answer to the first question is always yes? And that's really the essence of agile to me. Now, the agile.
Is that agile with a capital A or lowercase?
Well, that's like kind of a lowercase a agile. Okay. I mean, that's really what is agility, but kind of the ability to react to things very quickly.
Right. That's almost a proper definition of agility. And that could even be applied to a person.
Right. And so certainly a lot of the agile with a big A processes like Scrum, XP, any of those, they're not anti-agile with a little A, but I think that if somebody just kind of buys the book and just does those things by the book without really understanding the philosophies behind it, you're kind of doomed to fail with it. It really being agile is about inspecting your process and regularly looking at it and making the changes you need to make in order to be more effective. So while I might start a team saying, hey, Scrum is a pretty good place to start, you know, we look at breaking up our work and developing in iterations and having kind of team ownership of everything that's going on. After several iterations of going through that process and releasing and seeing what's wrong, you might end up with something that doesn't look quite like Scrum. You might have a lot of it. You might change some of it. In particular, on the Project DX team, when I first came on there, we were doing Scrum. An interesting way of doing it, though, is that we had basically in our release cycle, we had 2 3-week development sprints, and then it was followed by basically a 2-week beta where we would go through and do QA, and then 2 weeks of basically customer beta, where we'd actually put it out to the people that were paying for the product and let them kind of go through and do this. So we ended up having a 10-week release cycle, which really didn't work very well. And that was the situation when I first came into the team. The problem that we'd have is the reason we had that release cycle was because kind of executive management talking to the customers wanted to be able to say, oh, over the next 10 weeks, here's the list of things we're going to deliver. And this is what it is. Now, 10 weeks is certainly a lot shorter than you get in a lot of people's release cycles, but The problem was for us as a new startup business, the market changed, you know, or at least our perception of the market changed more than once every 10 weeks. So we would react to that during that 10-week cycle. You'd get in, you'd have your plan, and then 2 weeks in, oh, sorry, we actually got to do this. And we would make those adjustments and deliver things. So at the end of 10 weeks, we would deliver something of value, and it would kind of match what our expectations of what we needed to have at that moment were. But then you'd have kind of executive management looking at the list of things you said you'd do in over that 10 weeks and the list of things you did do, and they wouldn't match up. And so there was a question of, you know, hey, why didn't you guys do what you said you were going to do? Well, because it didn't make sense to do that. It made sense to do this. So still kind of, I was still in my consulting role at that point, but we went through and did some retrospectives at that point and looked at it and said, you know, what really is the purpose of that 10-week cycle? And ended up out of that trying a Kanban process for a while.
Mm-hmm. And then that's spelled K-A-N-B-A-N, just correct. For those of us who may not necessarily speak English or are listening to the show.
Right. And that process largely does away with the concept of fixed iterations.
Mm-hmm. I've got a Kanban board for myself, actually, right here.
And it's about mapping the value stream and kind of mm-hmm. taking one chunk of work and moving it through and making sure, okay, done is done. You don't, you know, deliver something in the first 3-week sprint and then wait 4 weeks later to find out, oh, there are some problems with it in QA, and then have to kind of go back and fix a whole bunch of bugs in 2 weeks before you actually release something mm-hmm. to production. And so we tried that for a while. Worked pretty good in terms of making sure that things kind of got out the way they were supposed to with, you know, done is done. But we found that it did kind of hamper our predictability of, you know, well, what does the next 6 months look like when we were only looking kind of at one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. Ended up from there kind of going back to more of an iterative planning cycle, but cut it down from a 10-week release cycle to saying, well, we're going to release every 2 weeks, no matter what. And we're going to plan what we can fit in there, and whatever actually gets done and accepted mm-hmm. and is fully done makes it into the release for that sprint.
So when I've worked on agile teams in the past and we start to squeeze that 10 weeks or 12 weeks or quarterly or whatever the standard release in into that kind of ideal 2 weeks, and 2 weeks or 3 weeks, depending on the size of the team, kind of consistently comes up as the ideal. The number one thing that that we start discussing or becomes an issue is, of those, you know, 2 weeks of that 10 days, effectively 10 business days, how many days are administrative overhead? Like, what processes are going to cost us? Are we going to spend an entire day doing quote unquote the build or code signing or whatever administrivia that's not directly related to delivering customer value, but it still absolutely has to be done? How did you do that? Did you assign a person in order to do that? Like, what we ended up doing in a compiled world, because you're a Ruby person and I'm a .NET person. So we're in a static analysis kind of where we have a build and a build process, and there's compiler, static analysis and stuff. We ended up having a build engineer, and we pushed a lot of the agile administrivia, you know, onto that individual. How does it work in a Ruby world?
So that's actually been something that's been pretty interesting for us over the last, say, 3 months. When we started back onto the kind of release every 2 weeks cycle, for the first month and a half of that, it was basically hell for me. because what was happening was we'd have developers writing code on stories. At the time, we used Git for our source control, and at the time, everybody was just contributing basically directly to master. And then what would happen is you'd get to kind of the end of that 2 week cycle. You'd have some of your stories that were QA'd and ready to go, but not always all of them got done. And then I was sitting there, you know, the day before we were supposed to go out and put the release candidate out to our staging server, and having to kind of tease apart these commits, and would be in merge hell whenever I'd have to kind of pull some commits out for stories that didn't make it in. And literally was pulling my hair out, staying till like 8 o'clock in the evening on that particular day, trying to deal with merge commits on code that I didn't write, things like that. So we basically instituted some changes with our process there, where we now develop each story in its own branch. We have a production branch in the repository that always represents what's actually out in production. And then once we do a production release, we make a sprint branch that's based off of that. And then the story branches are based off of the sprint branch. And now when we go to acceptance with a particular feature, that feature is pushed out on its own to our development server for our QA folks and product owners to look at and do acceptance. And then once it's accepted, it gets merged entirely back into the sprint branch. And then anybody else who's working on features for that release will rebase that branch off of the sprint branch at that time. So that way, whatever's in the sprint is always QA'd, accepted, done is done work. And then everybody else's branch is based off of that and they move it in. So now when we go to do releases, it's, you know, a 5-minute job for me to actually put it together, because it's basically, okay, take the sprint branch, merge it into production, push it to staging.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself, get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us.
How much overhead was involved in actually putting that together? Because sometimes, and I'm not saying this is the way to do it, I'm just saying this is the way that it's happened on teams I've been involved, is there's sometimes a 2 weeks, you know, 2 week, let's all freak out and get that stuff done sprint. Like, we're not going to get any work done at all. We're just going to learn Git, or we're going to learn the new system or whatever. I mean, how are you making these incremental changes? Like, you just described how you have production and then sprints and then stories. You didn't just invent that like some Wednesday morning. That needed to be introduced and implemented and get everyone on board and educate them and then make sure that everyone does it. Because if that is a human process that you described, I mean, the tool is great. Certainly you could do that similarly in Subversion or other systems, but ultimately you needed to get everybody on board. Was that a 2-week sprint to let people know, here's what we're going to do?
Well, honestly, we kind of had realized the problem was there for a while, and my team members kind of saw me pulling my hair out and, you know, occasionally going off on a rant over a really bad merge commit, and I was really stressed out, which wasn't good for me and wasn't good for the team. So we had essentially a team meeting, at one point, and kind of sat down and brainstormed how we could make this better. So everybody was kind of involved in inventing the solution that we were going to do. And I have the advantage of being on a relatively small team. There are about 8 of us now, I think, on the development team. So we didn't have a whole lot of problems with kind of instituting that. We basically said, okay, next sprint, we're going to start doing this. And just made the cutover. Everybody was already comfortable with Git and branching and merging and things like that. So it wasn't a huge transition for people at that point.
Is that because of the size of the team? This is, only you said it was 8 people. If it was 100,
if it was 100, I would think that would be a lot more difficult. Of the number of lines of communication, really, to make sure everybody's on the same page. With a small team and when you have a process that's driven by the team and a self-organizing team and they're part of inventing that solution, I think it's a lot easier to get everybody on board with it. So even if there are people that don't necessarily 100% agree that it's the way we should go, as long as you kind of get the consensus of, well, you know, I don't 100% agree, but I'm willing to go along with what the team thinks and we'll try this for a while. It wasn't really that hard to transition over to that system.
You just brought up an interesting term I want you to dig into a little bit. You said a self-organizing team. Well, right. Talk to me a little bit more about what that means.
So it's interesting, and something that I had to think about too coming on as manager of the software development team is what is kind of the manager's role on a self-organizing team. You know, on a lot of teams, you have the manager and you have the developers kind of working under them, and the manager kind of sets all of the process and how you're going to do things. And maybe you'll get some input from the team, but ultimately saying, well, this is the way we're going to do it, handing it down. I purposefully viewed my role as manager a little bit differently and see it as more of a facilitator as far as the team is concerned. In other words, I'm not any more important or above anyone on the team. I'm equally important, and I have a specific role to fill, which is to kind of make sure that they don't have obstacles in their way to development. They have the tools they need to do their job. They have, you know, the purpose. They have kind of the goal of what they're trying to achieve. And other than that, I think the process that's used for development and the way that they're going to do the work, if you've hired reasonably good software developers in the first place, you know, they're professionals. You can trust them to kind of work together and figure out what the best way is for them to do their job. As long as they know what they're supposed to be doing, you know, you can have that discussion and work together and say, this is the process together that we come up with and think will work the best for us so that we can deliver this software, you know, at high quality and in a reasonable amount of time.
So this might be a silly analogy, but my mind always puts things, as I'm learning, I'm trying to absorb what you're saying, and then I put it into an analogy that works for me. And I wonder if you think this works for other people, but is it kind of like, you know, swimming, doing a swimming relay? And except the rules are a little bit more loose than Olympic swimming. This guy wants to do freestyle and that guy wants to do a backstroke. That's totally up to you. But we're heading that direction. And the rules are we stay within these lines and we know what our goal is and we're going to try to beat our time. Swim any way you want to. You're a professional. Just get that direction as long as we all point in the right way.
Yes and no. I think that the basics of that are correct, and certainly there, I think that you need to make room for every individual developer to have some flexibility in the way they are going to work. At the same time, it's it would be sort of like a relay where, you know, you have several people on your team swimming at one time and you want to coordinate those people. So there does need to be a little bit more consensus around the way people are working.
Where's the room for creativity though? I mean, that's one of the things. Sometimes the more senior, like you kind of said without saying that, well, if you hired senior guys, you know, they know what they're doing, you trust them. But
I didn't say senior.
I know. You danced around that. Why didn't you say senior?
Because I think that there is, you know, I think some people have an innate ability to do software development well. I'm not saying it's something that necessarily can't be learned. I think if somebody wants to learn it, they will learn to do it well.
Yeah. One of my old bosses said, if you're putting together a basketball team, you can't teach height.
Right. Right. But, you know, at the same time, I have some relatively young software developers on my team who I look at and say, you know, wow, these people are going to be really great at this and are really great at this currently. So it wasn't a matter of seniority. It was more a matter of attitude, really. A sense of professionalism, craftsmanship, if you will, that they really care about doing it right. And not only about doing it right, because doing it right at the expense of the customer isn't necessarily such a good thing, but doing it right in such a way that the customer is also satisfied with what you're doing.
That is such a hard thing to quantify, to even discuss. I made a weak attempt a number of years ago where I wrote a blog post called The 501 Developer. And I described this developer was like, hey, it's 5 o'clock. Oh, it's 501. Hey, can I punch out? You know, I'm going to go home. And people missed the point. They thought I was talking about your level of commitment to the number of hours at work. When I refer to a guy who's a 501 developer, I'm referring to the opposite of what you just described.
Right.
You know, you want a person who is a steward of the code. When you say collective code ownership, they're like, oh yeah, we as a group, as a collective own this thing. That's that sense of aesthetic to the overall project and the way that it runs. How do you teach that? You know, how do you, it's like an art appreciation class. You know, we should teach code appreciation classes in college so that people can come out and appreciate that when a team is really working on all cylinders and everything's firing, that's just a beautiful thing. I mean, you must have those sprints where it's just like two or three sprints in a row. It's just like boom, boom, boom. Hey man, we're releasing software and it's awesome. And everybody from the junior guy to the senior guy is playing their role.
Yeah. I mean, that is something, you know, that we still struggle with, I think, of how to organize things during a sprint. So I don't want to pretend that I have all the answers and that, oh, if I'm managing a team, everything's going to go swimmingly all of the time.
It's utopia over there. We should all work at your company.
But that's kind of the point of agile development is you can never really assume that. You always have to inspect what you're doing. Because not only are you not going to get it right, but the environment around you changes too. So you, even if you had it perfect for one sprint, the same thing might not work the next sprint.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Well, back to my now realizing poor swimming analogy. Where is the room for creativity then? Because when I was kind of trying to put that together, I'm thinking about everyone has their own style and their own way to do things. Sometimes when I have had processes kind of imposed upon me from above, my reaction as the developer on the ground is that this is really cramping my style. Do you mean, are these processes so lightweight that no one feels like they're being, their creativity or their sense of aesthetic is being oppressed at all?
I would hope that the answer on my team is that they don't feel that way. Certainly no one's specifically told me that they feel that way.
Mm-hmm. And what room does architecture play?
So we have one person on our team right now who is the architect, the software architect for our platform. He's relatively new at doing that job. He was the original one person, developer that was on the team when I originally started consulting with them. So he's kind of grown the system from the ground up, understands what's there the best. But in terms of doing formal software architecture is very new at doing that. So it's a learning experience for him. And I think a learning experience for the team in terms of how we're going to work within those bounds. I kind of see it as his position being looking at the whole platform from kind of the macro level and saying, okay, we have this big application here and this other part that fits into it. And how are those going to communicate across? What are the APIs going to be? Mm-hmm. What are the data formats going to be? How do we make sure it's open, mm-hmm. And extensible, things like that? But specifically not getting into the level of, okay, you're going to use this class and call it this, and it's going to have these specific methods on it inside that. Mm-hmm. His job is to kind of have the whole view of the system, across whatever sub teams we may eventually come up with and make sure that it all gels together really nicely.
How does that fit together in terms of user stories? Because I can understand where, Joe developer is going to make some screens. And then that's a very clear user story and you can describe the interactions and it's spec'd out and that person can then start running in their direction and do their thing. Then you've got architecture guy who's got a vision in his mind that may span multiple sprints. What do those stories look like and how does he work that into an agile process?
I'm not sure that those work in terms of a user story. I think at that point, it's important that your overall product has some cohesion to it and some, you know, mission statement about what is the big thing that we're doing. And so he's going to look at, you know, kind of a 6 month to 12 month plan of where in general do we think we're headed with this product. And it may change during that time and he may have to go back to the drawing board with some things, but he does need to look out that far, and kind of see what components we think are going to be involved in here and start working on how those are going to come together. So it's definitely a larger level than the specific, oh, the user is going to click on this and see this and fulfill this specific need. It's more about, you know, how can we make sure this whole platform is designed in such a way that when we get a user story that we maybe weren't really expecting, we can still adapt to that pretty easily and quickly.
Sometimes trying to think a little bit more about what I was trying to express before about creativity is there's a saying that, you know, everyone wants to be the architect, but here you said you basically assign that to one person. So the team agrees that one individual is going to be focusing on architecture.
Yeah, I think you know, his position is definitely to be the one who kind of has that in his mind, mm-hmm. and is drawing up, you know, whatever level of documentation we may need, both for communication inside our team as well as communication to external stakeholders about what we're doing. It is important, and the person that's doing it for us agrees that it's important that he's not in some, you know, room away from us kind of doing this in a vacuum. He takes input from the team. You know, we meet and talk about these things. He's getting ideas. He's just ultimately the go-to person for, okay, given all of the discussion we've had, what is, you know, the consensus and what is the design of this going forward? So I think it is important to have one person that you can go to who, you know, has a really good handle on that bit of it.
And then kind of finally, I want to come back to where we started, which was that you started as a consultant. And you said that there was something about this team that made you want to invest in their success more. You wanted to stick around. I mean, it's almost like as a consultant, and I've done this too, I call it whiteboarding for money. You know, you're kind of flitting from place to place in this kind of serial monogamy, and you spend time with someone for 6 months and 6 months. And then you basically decide to marry this group, drop out of the single life. And now you're married and you're building a family here at your new company. Was it the personalities of the guys? Was it the size of the group? What caused you to switch from an agile coach that went from place to place doing something fresh every?
You know, honestly, it was the amount of fun I was having, just working with the guys that were there. You know, it was both fun. You know, I looked forward to getting up and going to work every single day. There hasn't been a day since I've been with this team where I've thought, man, I don't really want to go to work today. And that's not been true in all of my jobs. And it was, you know, the specific personalities of the people on the team. I think, you know, to use the term, a real family atmosphere where you feel like, okay, these aren't just people I work with, but are people that I care about on a personal level. I care what's happening in their lives and, you know, they care what's happening in my life. And that just makes it's so much more enjoyable when you're going to spend 8 to 10 hours a day with a group of people if you actually get along really well. I discovered that, you know, my real passion in life and my career is making sure that people enjoy their jobs. You spend so much of your time doing your work that if you don't like it and you're not really passionate about what you're doing, that's really sad. And you should look at your life and what you're doing for a living and try to bring your work in line with kind of what your passion is. Software development wasn't necessarily my first choice as a career. I actually originally wanted to be a recreational therapist, believe it or not. Got into software development because, you know, my wife and I had a kid very young and it was something that, you know, I could earn a decent living at. And money was, very important back then.
It's funny how that is. Every software engineer that I've talked to is like, well, I do it for the money. Well, it is actually kind of fun, but one day I'll have so much money that I'll go back and do that thing that right. I originally wanted to do.
And I think that, you know, for a while I thought that, but what I've found is that as I've gotten more experience and kind of moved up the ladder a little bit, I've found myself in a position where I can actually bring software development in line with my personality and my overall goals of helping people, and helping people enjoy their lives. And I think that's why I decided to make that transition from, you know, a pure technical practitioner into managing a team, because when I had that opportunity to kind of protect what was going on at, you know, on the Project DX team, I wanted to kind of take that and make sure that as the team grew, we maintained that atmosphere where the people on the team really felt like they were enjoying their work and wanted to come to work every day.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much, John Wilger, for hanging out with me today and sharing your experience moving from a consultant into a full-time Agile role at a company. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.